This is Llewellyn Vaughn Lee, November 3rd, 1990. The story of Mushkil Gusha.
The story of Mushkil Gusha, which is an ancient Persian story of pre-Islamic origin. It's as well known in Persia as Cinderella is in Europe. So it's one of those ancient folk tales that has in a way been adapted and changed in different places in different times. It appears in Afghanistan, it appears in the Middle East, it's become very much part of the Middle Eastern culture. And so, like these great folk stories, fairy stories, it has an enormous amount to say about the dynamics of the unconscious. And the Sufis' loving stories also took it on. And it has a particular association with the Sufi order to which I belong, in that there's a story about Bahauddin Naqshband. I belong to this order called the Naqshbandi Sufi order, named after Bahauddin Naqshband, who lived in the 14th century. And just remember that Mushkil Gusha means the remover of obstacles. And this is a story about Bahauddin's birth. A Sufi master, Khwaja Baba Samasi, was passing through a village later known as Arifan when he said to his companions, "This soil smells of a hero." Passing again soon after, he said, "The smell is stronger. Be sure that the hero is born." In fact, 3 days previously, Bahauddin came into the world. A while later, the child's grandfather, according to the custom of the time, placed a gift on Bahauddin's heart and asked Baba Samasi to bless him. The Khwaja said, "This is the hero whose smell we were aware of. Before long, the aroma will spread through the world and he will become the Mushkil Gusha of the people of love." So, it's very much part of our Sufi tradition as well as being a Middle Eastern story. And the whole of the story of Mushkil Gusha is about allowing the transpersonal dimension to enter into our ordinary everyday life. And really recognizing that it's that transpersonal dimension that removes the obstacles, that solves our problems. That we don't do it ourselves. And it is also learning to work with the transpersonal dimension, which functions very differently to the way our conscious mind functions. And the story of Mushkil Gusha touches on some of the most important issues that relate to experiencing and integrating the potential that the inner world has to offer. And at the same time, it's stressed throughout the story that the story of Mushkil Gusha is not just the story that Michael is going to read you. It is the story of anyone who receives help from within, whether through dreams, meditation, or any other way by which the transpersonal is able to enter into our lives. And I give you a beautiful example. The first time I gave this talk on Mushkil Gusha was in a retreat in Germany a couple of years ago. And there was one woman who came from Czechoslovakia, and her English wasn't that good. And she heard the story of Mushkil Gusha and was very moved by it, but felt she didn't really understand what it meant. And the next morning, in the small town where the retreat was happening, there was a little chapel. And the next morning she went into this chapel, and suddenly the whole of this chapel was filled by this very, very beautiful vermilion light. And she saw it and was totally amazed, and then said, or thought to herself, "This light can't be for me." And the moment she thought that, the light vanished. And then she understood the real meaning of the story of Mushkil Gusha. So in its essence, Mushkil Gusha is a story of our own individual relationship with the inner world. And because we are living at a time when there is great need to realize the healing power that lies within us, it's like one of the sort of most extraordinary sayings Jung left behind was, "The world today hangs by a thin thread, and that thread is the psyche of man." That really he saw the key to the world's problems is to do with man's relationship with his psyche. It's underlying, foundational. And so we must remember the healing power that comes from within. And there's a lovely line that runs throughout this story, which says, "When the story of Mushkil Gusha is told, the people who are in real need will be able to find their way." I won't say any more about that now, but Michael will read the story, and then for the rest of this morning I will discuss it, and then we have a group discussion on it this afternoon. So like these stories, don't always try to listen with your mind, because these stories, they don't speak to the mind. They actually speak directly to the unconscious. And so you have to learn to be open, to allow your unconscious to respond, to hold the images. It's like actually also when you work with dreams, you don't listen with your mind to dreams. You listen with your unconscious. And anyway.
This is the story of Mushkil Gusha. Once upon a time, there was a Baba Kartan, a prickly bush digger, who lived with his wife and daughter in a very small house outside the town. Each day, he would go out to dig prickly bushes in order to take them to the town and sell for firewood. With the proceeds, he would buy simple food for his wife and daughter. They always had enough to eat and remained thankful to God. However, there came a day when his daughter complained to him that she was fed up with always eating such plain food. His daughter asked, "Why can't we be like some of the townsfolk and have different foods to eat?" So persistent were his wife and daughter that the poor man decided to try and please them. That day, he went far out into the scrubland to find more wood than usual. He dug up a large amount of bushes and brought them back. But when he returned, it was already quite dark and there was no light in the house. His wife and daughter thought that he was spending the night in the town and had gone to sleep. They were both heavy sleepers and were not woken by his knocking. Unable to enter his own house, the bush digger lay down on the ground outside, and because he was so tired, he soon fell fast asleep. But the ground was hard and cold, and with the first dew in the early hours, the bush digger awoke. Again he knocked on the door of his house, and again there was no answer. But this time he was both cold and hungry, and he decided to go very early to work. This time he went even further and found more wood than before. But having gone so far out into the scrubland, it was again late when he returned. Once again the two women were fast asleep and did not respond to his knocking. His wife and daughter had been worried about him, but presumed that he had met some friends in the town and stayed with them. This had happened a few times before, so they had eaten their simple supper and gone to bed. Tired and even hungrier, the bush digger lay down on the cold ground. Just as he was falling asleep, he thought he heard a voice that said, "Wake up! Leave your bundle of bushes and come this way. If you need enough, and you want little enough, you shall find wonderful food." So the bush digger got up, followed the direction of the voice into the darkness. But there was nothing there, and so dark was the night that he realized that he could not find his way back to his house. Not only was he tired and hungry, but he was lost. He just lay down on the ground, feeling miserable, and tried to sleep. But he was too miserable to sleep. So he looked back over everything that had happened to him since his daughter had asked for something more than their simple diet. As if telling himself a story, he told himself the events of the last 2 days. The moment he had finished telling the story to himself, he thought he heard another voice. This voice, which seemed to come from above, asked him why he was so miserable. Once again, the bush digger told his story. Then the voice told him to close his eyes and climb up a step. "What step?" the poor man asked. "I cannot see any step." "Just do as you're told," the voice answered. So the man closed his eyes and climbed this imaginary step. It felt very real. And then there was another step, and another. The man found that he could climb very easily, and he went up and up. Then the steps ended, and the voice said, "Now you can open your eyes." Bush digger opened his eyes and saw that he was in a great desert. The sun beat down from above, and around him on the ground there were many different coloured pebbles which glistened in the sunshine. Once again the voice spoke to him, "Pick up as many of these stones as you can, then close your eyes and go back down the steps." The man looked around to see where the voice came from, but he could see nobody there. So he did as he was told. He filled his pockets with stones, closed his eyes, and went down the invisible steps. When he came to the bottom of the steps, he opened his eyes and found that he was in front of his own house. Day was breaking, and he heard from inside the sounds of his wife and daughter getting up. He knocked on the door, and his daughter opened it. He went inside, and they shared some dried fruit together, and he told them what had happened. He emptied his pockets on the table, and the stones he had picked up from the deserts rolled out. The astonishment of both his wife and his daughter. When they had all finished their simple breakfast, once again the bush digger heard a voice speaking to him. But only he could hear the voice. It spoke very, very clearly to him. "What has happened to you has been through the grace of Mushkil Gusha. You must remember that Mushkil Gusha is always present, even if you do not realize it. Each Thursday, you must eat some dried fruit and give some to someone in need. Then, if you tell the story of Mushkil Gusha, then you must tell the story of Mushkil Gusha. If you do this, the story of Mushkil Gusha will always be remembered, and those who are in real need will be able to find their way." The man then put the stones away in a corner near the stove. They looked very ordinary and he did not know what to do with them. Then he carried all the wood he had collected into the town, where he sold it for a good price. As well as their staple food, he bought his wife and daughter some delicacies that he knew they would like, and returned home. That evening they had a delicious meal together. And so the life of the prickly bush digger appeared to return to normal. He went out each day to dig prickly bushes. He took these to the town to sell. However, he always found big bushes that dug up easily, and so he was able to buy a few different types of food. When next Thursday came, he'd forgotten all about Mushkil Gusha. During the evening, his nearest neighbour, who lived half a mile distant, knocked at the door. His neighbour's fire had gone out, and he had come to ask for a couple of hot coals. When the bush digger opened the door, the neighbour said, "Can I borrow one of your coals that is glowing so brightly? I can see the light through the window as I was walking here." Looking in through his own window, the bush digger saw the stones that he had left by the stove were glowing very brightly. But when he went to where they were placed, he found that the light was cold and could not light a fire. So in embarrassment, he returned to his neighbour and said, "I'm afraid that you're mistaken. I don't have any coals." And he shut the door in his neighbour's face, and then also closed the shutters of the window. Together with his wife and daughter, he went again to look at the stones and discovered that they had turned into precious jewels. "Now we have a real reason to celebrate," he said. "Bit by bit, I can take these stones to the neighboring towns and sell them. Then we can build ourselves a palace and live like kings." And this is precisely what they did. Then one day, it so happened that the king, accompanied by his vizirs, was going back to his palace after a day of hunting. By chance, he passed the lofty new palace built by the bush digger, and being extremely surprised, he inquired about the owner. His courtiers informed him that it had been built quite recently and that nobody knew who owned it. All anyone knew was that the owner's name was Lyle Sodega, which means gem trader. Hearing this, the king consulted with his left hand and right hand vizars. Again, one of them suggested they go to the palace and, under the pretext of getting some water for the king, try to find out what was going on and who owned it. Everyone agreed, and so they approached the palace, and when someone came to the door, one of the courtiers said, "His Imperial Majesty, the centre of the universe, is returning to his palace from hunting and is thirsty. We wish to have some water." So it happened that the bush digger himself answered the door. And having heard the request, he bowed and saying, "But of course, by all means, it is a pleasure." Then he rushed in and filled a gold and jewel-studded cup with cardamom and rosewater sherbet and handed it over to the king. After drinking the sherbet, the king looked at the cup and said, "What a beautiful cup. There is nothing like it in my entire treasury." The prickly bush digger bowed once more and said, "May I present it to you, my majesty?" The king was pleased. Then he asked who owned the palace, and the bush digger answered, "Your majesty, it belongs to your servant and slave, Lyle Soldigger." The king headed home without waiting any longer. On his arrival, he ran to his daughter, who inquired why he was back so early. The king told her the entire story, and having no playmate, the princess said, "I wish you had asked him whether he had a daughter about my age so that she could be my lady-in-waiting." The king immediately sent some of his servants to inquire. On their return, they reported that not only has the Soldigger a daughter, but that she is so beautiful, she calls on the moon not to come up, for she can illumine the night by herself. They concluded that she was perfect to become the princess's lady-in-waiting. The princess dispatched her servants to bring her over. The bush digger's daughter was delighted and started for the king's palace. At first, the princess felt jealous of the girl's beauty, but they soon became fast friends. They met every day and would often go and swim and play in a stream with her, which the king had made for his daughter. Then one day, the princess was wearing a beautiful necklace, and before she began bathing, she took it off and hung it on a tree beside the stream. When she had got out of the water, she forgot that she had hung it on the tree, and not being able to find it, she decided that her new lady-in-waiting had stolen it. The princess told this to her father, who had the girl, her mother, and father arrested. The two women were sold into slavery, and the man was sent to prison. The curious thing, however, was that when the soldiers went to confiscate the Soldigger's palace, both the palace and the furniture they found had turned to smoke and disappeared. The bush digger's newfound wealth had come to a sorry end. He was treated like a common criminal. No more sherbet or delicate meats for his meals. He had to live off bread and water and sleep on dirty straw. Then, one Wednesday night, he had a dream. A luminous, holy man, wearing green slippers, cloak and turban, approached him and, touching him with his walking stick, said, "Oh, you, inwardly blind, you have forgotten to remember Mushkil Gusha. Now get up. There is a penny hidden under the door sill. Take it, buy some dried fruit, and fulfill your vow." The man looked up at the start and then remembered his dream. At the same time, he realized that it was now Thursday. He searched for the penny, and sure enough, it was there. He picked up the money and called through the keyhole to the jailer, saying, "God bless you, brother. Please take this coin and buy me some dried fruit." The guard said, "I must say you have some nerve. You want me to go on a silly errand so you can escape? No." A couple of minutes later, the bush digger repeated the same request to a man on a horse he saw passing outside the jail window, but the man made some excuse and went on his way. Then he noticed an old woman slowly walking by. The man appealed to her. God bless you, lady. Please take this penny and get me some dried fruit so that I can fulfill my vow. The old woman replied, yes, sir, my son is dying. But never mind, I will help you. So the old woman brought the fruit, and the bush digger thanked her and asked him if she would share it with him and just listen to his story. She consented. And just as he had finished telling his story, someone rushed by and called out to the old woman, you may not believe this, but your son has managed to escape the claws of Azrael, the angel of death. He is calling for you. Now that day, the princess happened to go again to bathe in the stream. She thought she saw her necklace lying at the bottom of the stream, but as she looked again, she realized that it was a reflection of her necklace that she saw. She looked up, and there, still hanging on the branch where she had left it, was her necklace. She rushed to the king and told him the news. The king then ordered the bush digger and his family to be free. Afterwards, the princess and the girl became friends again. And strangely enough, when the prickly bush digger and his wife went back to their home, they noticed that their palace was still there. So once again, the prickly bush digger became Lyle Sodinger. And they all lived happily ever after. We beseech God to fulfill your wishes as he fulfilled theirs. God willing.
So that's one version of the story of Mushkil Glusha. And it begins with the bush digger, which is the Persian equivalent of the woodcutter. And why do we find woodcutters in so many fairy stories? Because they live not in the civilized environment of the town, but they live close to the unconscious, the forest, the wood. You find it in dreams, you find it in fairy stories. It's the natural world of the unconscious. And that is where the transformation takes place, in the unconscious. So he represents somebody who works and lives in that world, very close to the unconscious. And the story really begins, though, when his daughter complains she wants different foods to eat. Now, from a Jungian point of view, his daughter can be seen as his anima, his soul figure. And there comes a time in people's lives when their inner self says it wants something else. This usually creates a dissatisfaction in the individual. Suddenly, the previous life they lived is no longer fulfilling. And they don't know why, and they don't know what to do about it. Something inside asks for something more. Now, people respond to this call in different ways. And what the bush digger did was he said, well, let's go out and I'll dig up more bushes. This is sort of the more of the same answer. If my present job and everything isn't fulfilling, let's get a better one. Let's go and work harder and earn more money so I can buy a swimming pool, a bigger car. It's a very natural response. You don't feel fulfilled by what you're doing, so you want more. But something very interesting happened to the bush digger when he responded in this way, as he found the door of his house was locked against him and he couldn't get in. He's locked out. Why? He's locked out of his innermost self because he hasn't done the right thing. His response was not appropriate. And it's very significant that he knocks on the door of his house three times before he is answered. There is an esoteric tradition that if you ask a question three times, it must be answered. And there is a similarly an esoteric tradition that if you try to do something three times and it doesn't work, leave it, forget it. If you do it the fourth time, you can push, you can get what you want, but you will pay the price. Learning to work with your inner self one learns to be sensitive, when to push, when not to push. And these ancient laws are to do with the inner dynamic of the soul. And if any of you know the Upanishads, the great Indian scriptures, there is one in the Katha Upanishad when the boy Nachiketas meets the spirit of death and three times asks to be told the truth about death before he is answered. And the first time the spirit of death promises him as many elephants and dancing girls as he wants, and the boy Nachiketas says, no, I want to know the truth about death. And the second time he asks, and again the spirit of death offers him castles and gold and jewels, and he says, no, I want to know the truth about death. And then comes one of the greatest descriptions there is of the self in all the literature. Smaller than small and greater than great. No bigger than a thumb dwelling in the heart. It's a beautiful, if you ever want a description of the self, of the Atma, go to the Katha Upanishad. It is superb. Maker of past and future. It's wonderful. But he has to ask three times. And then the transformation happens. The transformation begins. He hears a voice. The bush digger hears a voice saying, wake up, wake up. Leave your bundle of bushes and come this way. If you need enough and want little enough, you shall find wonderful food. Now the first thing he says is, leave your bundle of bushes. Wake up, leave your bundle of bushes and come this way. You have to leave behind your old attitudes before you can begin. If you like, you have to step into the dark. If you take your old conditioning, your old attitudes with you, you won't see anything except your old attitudes, your old conditioning. The inner processes of transformation are a gamble because you have to gamble yourself. You have to say, yes, I believe in it. I believe there is this inner process of transformation. If you don't believe in it, then in a way it can't believe in you. So he hears this voice saying, leave your bundle and come this way, and he does. And then the voice says this saying, which I think should be engraven in anybody interested in working with themselves. If you need enough and you want little enough, if you need enough and you want little enough, you shall find wonderful food. And here we have the whole distinction between need and want. Want is to do with the ego. Want is to do with the little self. If you look at yourself, you'll find all day long you are chasing your wants. You want this, you want that. You have desires, you run after them. Now there are also needs. It's like you need to have food to eat, you need to have clothing, you need to have shelter, you need to have love. Those are needs. And you have a right to have your needs fulfilled. And then there are the deeper needs. There are the needs of the soul. And you have to need enough. You have to... Like I was saying yesterday, you wouldn't enter the whole process of the inner journey unless something inside you was pushing. Because it's so painful and it's so difficult and you have to leave so much behind. But you have this need, you have this inner... Well, the Sufis call it longing. But there is something inside you which is always asking to be fulfilled. And it doesn't come again from the ego. It has nothing to do with the ego. It's to do with the soul. If you need enough and want little enough. Why want little enough? Because the ego has to get out of the way. Because the processes of inner transformation have very little to do with the ego. They take you far beyond the ego. They are to do with the soul. One's inner need, the need of the soul, is only answered if it is great enough. For then the human being calls out in such a way that the call must be answered. If you have a need, And sometimes you don't even know what that need is. You just know that you need something. Then somewhere you call out, and if the call is strong enough, it must be answered. There is the call and the echo. It's the way the whole process works. It's a relationship. Working with the unconscious is a two-way relationship. And always remember that the unconscious is the stronger partner. So then it is answered. And there is also something why you must want little enough, because if you are wanting all the time, you can't hear your needs. The desires of the ego, what you want, gets in the way. It's very difficult when you're rushing about in the external world to give enough time and attention to the inner world. Which is why at the beginning it's often important to set aside a time each day for the inner world. When you take the telephone off the hook, when you go into a... It can be 15 minutes, it doesn't matter how long it is, but just a sacred space in your life where the inner world is given its attention. And then you cut out the desires of the ego and you listen to the needs of the soul. And they are very, very different. And they follow different laws. And eventually you get to know them and you get to live with them. At first, the bush digger followed the direction of the voice into the darkness. He trusted this voice. His need was great enough. He trusted this voice and went into the darkness, but there was nothing there. And not only was he tired and hungry, but he was lost. And this is a stage everybody goes through when they start the inward journey. They get to this place where they're lost and they're tired and they're hungry. Mrs. Tweedy uses the expression, some doors have closed behind you and other doors have not yet opened in front of you. You've turned your attention away from the values of the outer world. You've begun to look within. But you haven't yet had any experiences within. And so you're in this in-between stage, which is very difficult. You're tired, you're hungry, you want something and you're lost. You have no idea where you're going. Because the inward journey is, somebody said it's like shooting arrows in the dark. You see the bow, you see the arrow, but you don't see the target. You, the conscious mind, do not know where you're going, and you have to be prepared to be lost. You have to be prepared to be confused. From a spiritual point of view, confusion is often one of the best states, because it means you're not interfering. Like I was saying yesterday, if you know where you're going, don't bother to go. It's a waste of time. You've already got there. Yeah?
Well, do these stages, does this condition happen in cycles?
Yeah. It's a spiral path. It goes round and round and round and round. And you go through confusion and you go through stages of being lost and then you think you've found something and then you lose that again and you go onward and onward and onward. In the end, you get used to it. You get used to being lost. And you don't mind anymore. You know? But then that's easy, because once you begin to have experiences, you see how it works, and then it's easy. If anybody has a Christian background, St. Teresa of Avila describes this beautifully in her four stages of prayer. At the beginning, it's really hard work. You have to do it all yourself. Later on, it just gets given. If any of you are interested in that, it's beautifully put. So, at the beginning, he goes into the dark and there is nothing there and he falls asleep and before he falls asleep, he tells himself the story of everything that had happened to him since his daughter had asked for something more than their simple diet. And it is in telling this story that it is finally answered. Why is it so important to tell your story? Why is it so important to tell your dream? Because you put it outside of yourself and you create a space. If your story is all bunched up inside of you, if your dream is all caught up inside of you and there's no space, then there's nothing to hold an answer. You see, the answer always has to come into an empty space. If you're there full of yourself, there is no space for an answer. Because remember, from a psychological or spiritual point of view, the answer will always be totally different to what you ever expected. Why? Because it comes from a different dimension within yourself. As that Jung said somewhere, we never solve our problems, we grow out of them. They just don't matter anymore. Because we tune into a different level within ourselves. So he tells himself his story, and then he falls asleep and the voice speaks to him and asks him, why is he so miserable? Again he tells his story to this voice. And remember, in a dream, a voice is always the voice of the higher self. If you hear a voice in the dream, it is always the voice of a higher self. The part of you that knows. If you hear somebody speaking in a dream, that's different, if you see the person. But if it's a voice that has no shape, no form, you don't know where it's coming from, it's just a voice, that is the voice of the higher self, and you better follow what it says. And then the voice tells him to close his eyes and climb a step. When the bush digger says he doesn't see any step, he is answered, just do as you are told. And the first step is always an act of faith. You have to go into the dark and take this step. It's like the lady who had the dream yesterday. She jumped off the edge of the building and didn't mind. And that is what you have to do. Jung had this experience. He read Memories, Dreams, Reflections when he was just sitting at his desk. And he said, okay, I'm going to go. And he dropped and plummeted into the depths of his unconscious. And it's that that then began his own process of transformation that lasted about 4 years. And that he said that from those 4 years, the rest of his life's work was an elaboration of what happened in those 4 years. He learned everything in those 4 years. But at the beginning, he had to let go. He had to go into the unknown and trust. It was an act of faith. But then again, paradoxically, the faith is always given. You can't have faith, you can't get faith. It is given. And then you do it, and you go into the unknown. And then he finds himself on a staircase which he can climb very easily. But first you have to say yes. To me, that's the real meaning of free will. I think once you go into psychology a bit, you see that we have very little self-determination. We are so governed by unconscious patterns, by our conditioning, by our instinctual drives, that we have very little choice in what we do, much less than most people think. And you just have to look at the way people go from one relationship, and then they go into another relationship, which is exactly the same as the first relationship, because they're projecting exactly the same thing onto their partner, and get caught in exactly the same place. And they see them repeated again and again and again. You have free choice? No, you're pushed and driven by unconscious patterns. And I think for a lot of people, they really begin to work on themselves when they suddenly see these patterns that have driven them all their life and get fed up with it. Then they begin to go inside and try and change them. But the real meaning of free will, as far as I understand it, is one has the free will to say yes. One can say yes or one can say no. And then he's taken into this higher dimension, which one Jungian, Henry Corbin, calls the mundus imaginalis, the world of the imaginal, the world of the symbolic interior world. Jung called it the collective unconscious. The mundus imaginalis is somehow better because mundus imaginalis is the world of the imaginal. It is the world of images, it is the world of symbols. And something Corbin stresses, Corbin was a Jungian who also worked a lot with Sufi material. His best known book is something called Creative Imagination in the Sufism of Ibn al-Arabi. And he's found in the Sufi tradition exactly the same process of active imagination as Jung discovered in the alchemical tradition in the West. and which is very interesting. And exactly the same use of symbols and understanding of symbols, and how certain prayers are an evocation of symbols in that tradition. So he gets taken to this interior world, the world of the symbols, the world of the imagination. And this is the world that our ancestors lived in consciously, and children live in it consciously. They live in, especially young children, they live in this imaginal world in which dragons are real. You know the lovely fairy story, song, Puff the Magic Dragon, Live by the Sea. It's so absolutely accurate. Dragons live forever, but not so little boys. When the boy grows up, he forgets that inner symbolic world. When I see my daughter, she's 8 now. I mean, she's totally lived in the symbolic world. And it's something adults forget, that children live in the unconscious. They live and breathe in the unconscious. They live, of course, on a personal level, they live and breathe in the unconscious of their parents and act it all out. On an archetypal level, they live and breathe in the collective world of the collective unconscious. And of course, in other times, tribes lived directly in this archetypal world, in this symbolic world. Now as a culture, we have to go back to it. We have to find it again. We have to make that journey back home into our own symbolic interior world. And for this, the bush digger, this is given as an image of the desert. And the desert has a profound and clear-cut symbolism as the most propitious place for divine revelation. The desert is one of the great symbols. This is because the desert, insofar it is in a way a negative landscape, is the realm of abstraction located outside the sphere of existence. Furthermore, the desert is the domain of the sun, not as a creator of energy on earth, but as pure celestial radiance, blinding in its manifestation. The desert has this quality of being totally other to the world we live in. It's totally empty. It's very hard, it's very... And there is just the sun, there is just basically the light of our own self there. And that is the inner world to which the bush digger is taken. And that is the inner world in which, actually again, this woman who had this dream of falling off, jumping off the building, that was the landscape she was taken to, this rounded stone. The ancient part of herself. We have that ancient dimension within ourselves. And it is in that dimension that the real process of transformation takes place. Very deep within ourselves. That is where the energy for transformation comes. That is where all the healing comes from the center of ourself, from the rock. And this is what, in Christian terms, when Christ said, build your house upon a rock, build your church upon a rock, rather than upon sands, that is what he meant psychologically. You have to begin with the center of yourself. You can't begin the process of transformation with the ego, because the ego is... And it's why, to me, a lot of these sort of New Age transformational things you do in a weekend are a total waste of time, because they're not grounded in anything. You know, real inner work it takes a long time. You have to be grounded in yourself. And there he saw the stones. Now stones are another symbol of the self. It's our essence. We're rock hard somewhere within. Totally secure, totally firm. And he's told, pick up as many of these stones as you can, then close your eyes and go back down the steps. Now, what does it mean to take stones from the symbolic inner world back into your ordinary everyday life? And this is one of the most difficult things to do. It's easy to have a dream. Well, it's not easy. You're given a dream, you're given a vision, you're given a glimpse of this inner world. But how do you integrate it back into your ordinary everyday life? How do you take those stones back into the kitchen? It's very, very difficult. In his vision, the bush digger experienced the archetypal images of the self. He experienced that inner dimension. And yet Jung continually asserts these images only have meaning if they are integrated into the ordinary life of the individual, if they are lived. You have to live out your symbolic vision. Otherwise it is of no use whatsoever. And the rest of the story is about the difficulties he has in living out his vision that he has been given. Now, first of all, he takes them home, the doors opened, the stones, he's welcomed in, and he shared some dried fruit with his family as he told them what had happened. And this is the beginning of the ritual of Mushko Gusha. You share some fruit and tell your story. It's a very simple human thing in the Middle East. Dried fruit is the most basic substance. You share something with people, you have something very basic, something very simple, and you tell your inner story. So in that very act, the two become fused together as a ritual. And it's something very interesting, I find, because in our tradition or in our group, part of the importance is just being together. And so we drink tea and eat cookies, and they're just together. And going to different centers and retreats and places over America, I find that was something that hadn't really, a lot of people hadn't really appreciated, that the two need to come together. We went to one ashram and they do a lot of... And when this happens, when he performs this simple ritual, he tells his own inner story and shares dried fruit. Then a voice says, "What has happened to you has been through the grace of Mushko Gusha. You must remember that Mushko Gusha is always present, even if you do not realize it. Each Thursday you must eat some dried fruit and give to someone in need. Then you must tell the story of Mushko Gusha. If you do this, the story of Mushko Gusha will always be remembered, and those who are in real need will be able to find their way." Now, it's very, very important that you acknowledge the transpersonal dimension of what you have experienced and do not identify with it as yours. If you are given an inner experience, a glimpse, if you tune in somewhere, it's very easy to say it's mine. This is the ego. This is then causes what Jung called inflation. It causes immense trouble. It is very important to remember the transpersonal origin of the experience, to honor the gods. And at the same time, this story says you must also tell the story of Mushko Gusha. You must share your experience, because there is actually a spiritual law that you are never given for yourself, ever. You are only given for others. If you hoard it up within you, it goes rotten and you go rotten with it. And then finally there is this thing, if you do this, the story of Mushko Gusha will always be remembered, and those who are in real need will be able to find their way. And as in most stories, it's the very, very simple words that are the most profound. It's like you find dreams. The very simple dreams are often the most important. The ones that tell simple, direct messages. You know why? Because in our essence, we are simple. There's a lovely quote by Jung when he said, "It is so simple, if only simplicity were not the most difficult of things." We long for it to be complicated. You know why? Because the mind loves complications. And the heart is simple. In our essence, we are simple. The self is, to quote T.S. Eliot, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. We are very, very simple. And so the real messages that come to us, the real guidance, is always simple. But the mind loves the complicated theories. It loves to elaborate and confuse us. Yeah. Yeah, a condition of complete simplicity costing not less than everything. It's one of my favorite quotes from him. This comes from the Four Quartets. And it's very interesting, actually, this ritual of sharing the fruit and telling the story is an integral part now of Persian culture. And what actually happens is that if you have a problem, the person who has a problem ties some money, usually in coins, in the corner of a handkerchief and hands it to a dried fruit seller, who will then make up exactly the correct traditional combination of dried fruit and nuts. The shopkeeper passes this over to the customer, neither of whom utter a word during the course of the transaction. And this ritual takes place either on the first of each lunar month or on the last Thursday of each lunar month. Then the dried fruit is taken home and cleaned by several people. And the fruit and nuts are laid out in a cloth in five places, one at each corner and one in the center. And then Mushka Gusha is remembered and this ritual is shared. I actually know this because Michael's wife is Persian and his father described me this ritual that they have in Persia. So it's a beautiful example of an ancient tradition that is still a living part of a culture. And of course the handkerchief with the five piles of dried fruit is a total mandala. And what it actually says somewhere is the answers will always come from the self. Your problems can only be resolved from the level of the self. Because in the level of the self there is no duality, there is no should it be like this or should it be like that. One friend said to me, nice phrase, she said, if there is a choice, it's because there's a lack of understanding. If you think, should I do this or should I do that, you haven't quite understood. Because in the deepest part of you, there is no either or, there is just one. But that requires patience to wait. Like it said somewhere in Lao Tzu, have you the patience to wait till the water settles and you can see clearly for yourself? So the answer always comes from within, from the center of the mandala of oneself, always. But there is this also the very important thing of sharing the story of Mushka Gusha. And why? Why? Because an archetypal story, as I mentioned, does not just work on the level of the mind. It speaks directly to the unconscious of the people around. This is also belongs to fairy stories, though sadly in our culture fairy stories have now just given to children. They just felt they just belong to children, which is okay, our culture has moved on. In great works of art, and I studied Shakespeare for many years, the great works of art, again, speak directly to the unconscious. They bypass the conscious mind, which tends to get in the way anyway. They speak directly to the soul. Music does this, of course. Music is one of the most direct. That's why, you know, music can be very powerful, because again it bypasses the mind, which discriminates, which cuts things out. It speaks directly to the soul. And that's why I find sharing dreams so beautiful, because a dream, an archetypal dream, speaks to the dream within the people listening. And you have that when these great archetypal dreams are told, there is a resonance in the air. Because something very ancient is being spoken, and something that is living. It is an ancient dimension that is living, and that dimension is allowed to enter into this world. Normally we shut it out, and so it can't breathe. But if we share that part of ourselves, it actually resonates with that part of other people. And it allows that part of other people to speak to them, even if they don't know it. Because again, one of the things about the whole inner process is most of it happens way beyond the conscious mind. In ancient times, this is what rituals did. They tuned you in to the inner processes of the soul. Now for most of us, the great rituals have lost their numinosity. The churches are not full anymore. There is a shift in the symbolic energy in the collective unconscious. And it seems to me the shift is now towards the individual story. We're not interested in how it happens to everybody else. We want to know how it happens to ourselves. We want to find our own story. And when you listen to somebody's dream, you hear their own story, and that can resonate with your own story. And it's very, very powerful. But again, most of it happens beyond the conscious mind, so we don't value it. And it's very difficult, because what I've actually discovered is in the collective unconscious there is a very powerful shadow. And the shadow is the effect of a culture that does not believe in the unconscious. Now you know how powerful thought forms are, collective thought forms. But if you have a whole cultural idea that the unconscious doesn't exist, that makes it very difficult if you want to work with the unconscious. You have to confront this reality that the inner world does not exist. So it makes it twice as difficult. And that's why, for example, a dream group or a meditation group is so valuable, because it is a sharing of people. When they come together, they can support each other in acknowledging the reality of this inner world. I mean, there have been cultures in the past where the inner world was much more important than the outer world. Which is very strange to us, that there are... Jung had this lovely conversation with this Indian chief. The American Indians were an introverted culture in which the inner world was more important, the sacred world was more important. And this Indian chief said to Jung, he didn't understand these white people. They were so greedy and they're always looking for something. There seemed to be no peace about them. And he said, one thing he couldn't understand was they thought with their heads. And Jung said, well, where do you think with? And he said, well, we think with our hearts. It's a totally different way. Other cultures have at times functioned in a totally different way. And one of the difficulties is we're so conditioned this is the way it is. We presume this is the way it always has been and always will be. And when you start to work with the unconscious, you tune into a totally different way of living. Joseph Campbell said this very beautifully. He said, when you follow your bliss, you will find unseen doors, unseen hands will open doors you never knew existed. And anybody who's begun that knows it's totally true. You just happen to be in the right place at the right time, without trying. You begin to tune into an inner process. It's like, I find it so often, if you need a book, you walk into a bookshop and that book jumps out at you. Or a friend happens to give it to you, if you need to know something. You begin to work in tune with the rhythm of the soul. And again, once you know it works, once you've been in the right place at the right time and seen it happen for no logical reason whatsoever, then you get familiar with it, then it doesn't seem so strange after a while. And you learn to live more and more in tune with this and circumstances then work with you. You don't, it actually means a change in attitude in life. You don't go out and get what you want. You allow life to bring it to you. You trust in life. And then there is space for your own inner unfolding to take place. It's very, very different to, sadly, because we live in the culture, our education gives, we're not educated at all about the inner world, which, if you think of it, is totally schizophrenic. that when people go to school and everything, there is no education at all about the inner world, which is at least half of ourselves. So you do encounter that shadow, you do encounter that very strong Western thought form that says the inner world doesn't exist. But if you share a story, if you share a dream, if you share yourself, that deeper part of yourself, it allows other people to say yes, that also exists within them, it resonates. And I say it resonates beyond the conscious mind. And maybe in 5-10 years' time you suddenly click, that's what it was about. It doesn't matter because the time scale of the unconscious is not yesterday or tomorrow. You know, in the collective unconscious there aren't even cars there yet. If you go into the depths of the collective, they still ride horses. A century is a minute. That's why you often find if you go into the depths of the unconscious, the figures speak in a very archaic language. Because they haven't yet learned modern English. They have a different rhythm, a different space. Apparently Mary Louise von Franz had one figure and she just couldn't cope with it for a long time because it spoke in such an ancient language, she didn't like it. So it is a different world, a different rhythm. Thus the visionary experience of the bush digger is in itself an archetypal story describing how one who is in real need will always receive help from within. And that is a law. If you are in real need, you will always be helped. The difficulty is you're often helped in a way you don't understand and don't appreciate. Because sometimes you're helped by your circumstances becoming more difficult. And more difficult, and more difficult, because there's something you need to face, something you need to learn. However, the bush digger forgot what he was told, and don't we all? We get a dream, we get a hint, we think, yes, we'll do that. Then a few weeks later, we've totally forgotten about it. And get caught in the same old patterns, the same old rhythms. Now what happened with the bush digger at the beginning? He didn't know what to do with these stones, he put them in a corner. And went about his daily business. And here we have the whole difficulty of the self. Which the alchemists called the lapis, the stone. Lapis, and they described it as the commonest thing to be picked up anywhere. And the Christian tradition is called the cornerstone which the builders rejected. It is so ordinary. We all want something special, you see. We all want something other than what we are. And the self isn't that. The self is terribly, terribly ordinary. And it's so ordinary, we reject it. It is our own ordinary, everyday self. At the same time, it is something totally different. It's a paradox. But one of the difficulties of working with the self and its symbols is again that because from a worldly perspective and also that of our conscious mind, riches are to be found outside oneself. We have this enormous conditioning that tells us that wealth is outside. To me, it is the biggest contract that was ever perpetuated upon mankind. And if you ever find me a very wealthy man who's incredibly happy because he's wealthy, I have never yet found anybody. And I had one very powerful experience as a friend of my son's was very, very wealthy. I mean, incredibly wealthy. And they were very, very nice people. And I went there one afternoon to collect my son from playing there. And the emptiness in that house howled. I've never experienced such a painful emptiness. It was like a vacuum. It sucked up everything from inside of you. And it wasn't that the people, they were very kind, very generous, very sensitive people. But somehow their wealth created such an inner vacuum. It was painful. But again, we have a whole culture that says that wealth comes from outside. And I say, where this myth, you know, because I never found an example of it being true. But somehow we've all been conned along this line. And so we all, you know, hook, line and sinker. There is also another difficulty towards the self, and Jung put this very beautifully when he said, the known attitudes of the conscious mind have definable aims and purposes. Consciously we know what we're doing. We're going to do this, we're going to do that, etc. We're going to be a director or run a football team or whatever, it doesn't matter. But man's attitude towards the self is the only one that has no definable aim and no visible purpose. Once you work with your inner self, you have to realize that you don't know what you're doing. It's terribly simple, but terribly profound. It is easy enough to say self, but what exactly have we said? That remains shrouded in metaphysical darkness. I may define self as the totality of the conscious and the unconscious psyche, but this transcends our vision. It is a variable lapis invisibilatis. It is invisible. We don't know what we're talking about. It is a mystery. And this was the bush digger's problem. He didn't know what to do with these stones. He left them in the corner of his house and they got cold. Well, he read they were cold. And they were cold because he didn't feel them. If you have figures in a dream that are cold, it's because they're not love. They're not. This warmth comes from feeling. In the great fairy tales, it's the white witch freezes people into stone. You have this in the Narnia stories also by C.S. Lewis. It gets you cold, it takes you away from feeling into the parts of the unconscious where there is no feeling. And what's more, he ended up saying they were just his. A neighbor came and wanted something to light his fire. And he wouldn't give it to them. He wouldn't share what he had. He kept it for himself. And then he sold it to build himself a palace. This is the whole danger of inflation, in which you say, it belongs to me, it's mine. And anybody going into the unconscious encounters the danger of inflation. You think you've found something, and you want to hold on to it, you want to keep it for yourself. You don't want to share it. Again, there is a time when you shouldn't share it, when you have to keep it, like a seed. But you don't want to use it for yourself. If we have a little break for 10 minutes, I'll tell you a story. Afterwards, I suddenly feel everybody's had enough for a moment. So if you have a cup of tea and a cookie. I mentioned the importance about having the right attitude to the energy of the unconscious. Jung is very, very definite about that. He had his own encounter with inflation in his Siegfried dream when he had to kill Siegfried, which if you read Memories, Dreams, Reflections, you'll find. And it's really to do with the danger of what he calls the power principle. And I'll read you a story that comes from Africa. It's quoted by Helen Luke, who is a wonderful Jungian, in a book called The Inner Story. In an African village, a group of young women had banded together to humiliate one of their number, of whom they were jealous. and whom they had rejected because she was different. And especially because it seemed to them that she had a necklace of beads that was more beautiful than their necklaces. These jealous young women ran down to the banks of the river, and there they planned a trap for the envied one. When she joined them, they told her they had all thrown their necklaces into the river as an offering to the river god. The young woman was a person of generous heart, so she at once took off her own necklace and threw it into the river, whereupon the others dug up their necklaces, which they had buried in the sand, and went off laughing and sneering. The young woman, left alone, was very sad. She had been duped into a well-meant but foolish act, and she wandered along the riverbank, praying to the god to restore the necklace. There was no answer until at last she heard a voice bidding her plunge into a deep pool nearby. She didn't hesitate, for she knew it was the voice of a god. She plunged down into the unknown and found herself on the riverbed, where an old woman sat waiting. This old one was exceedingly ugly, even repulsive, for she was covered with open sores, and she spoke to the girl, saying, "Lick my sores." At once the girl obeyed out of her compassionate heart, and licked the repulsive sores as she had been asked to do. Then the old woman said to her, "Because you haven't held back and have licked my sores, I will hide you and protect you when the demon comes who devours the flesh of young women." At that she heard a roar, and a huge male monster came, calling out that he smelt a maiden there. But the old woman had hidden her away, and soon he went off cursing. Then the old woman said to the girl, "Here is your necklace." And she put around her neck beads of a far greater beauty than any she had had before. "Go back now," the old woman said, "to your village. But when you have gone a few yards from the pool, you will see a stone in the path. Pick up this rock and throw it back into the pool. Then go on without looking back and take up your ordinary life in your village." The young woman obeyed. She found the stone and threw it back and came to the village without a backward look. There the other girls quickly noticed her beautiful new necklace and clamored to know where she had found it. To which she replied it had been given to her by the old woman at the bottom of the pool in the river. Not waiting for more, they all rushed off in a body and jumped into the pool. And the old woman said to each of them, as she had said before, "Lick my sores." But these girls all laughed at her and said they wouldn't dream of doing anything so repulsive and useless too. And they demanded to be given necklaces at once. In the midst of all this, there came the roar of the giant demon, who seized upon those girls one after the other and made a mighty meal of them. And with that, the story comes to an end. This is a story told in many different forms all over Europe and in Africa about the right approach to working with the unconscious, the right attitude, which is fundamental. You do not go to the unconscious to get what you want. We just have to look at our culture to see what attitude that has created with the feminine of going and getting what you want. Ecologically, we are faced with a disaster caused by that attitude towards the feminine, towards our mother, the earth. And the feminine is as much as it is our mother, the earth, it is also the inner. The inner world is the world of the feminine. And this is in no way a sexist comment, as I've been accused of. The inner world is feminine by nature. And you don't go there and rape it. You don't go there because you want something. You go there to work with it. Remember, the bush digger used what he had got for his own egotistical purposes. He built himself a palace. And that is a very dangerous business. There are a large number of people who set themselves up as gurus in exactly the same way. They've been given something in the unconscious and they have used it for themselves, for their ego. Eventually, it is totally destructive. And this story, and all stories are like this, in which the stepdaughter comes back and the old woman showers her with tar, which sticks onto her forever, they're all the same. Except this story puts it very clearly. If you go into the unconscious to get something, you get gobbled up. You get devoured. In American mythology, this is the story of Moby Dick. And there's one book called Moby Dick, a Jungian Commentary. I can't remember who it's by now. It, maybe by Edinger, I can't remember. But it describes the psychological dynamic of Ahab, who was so affixed with the white whale that it destroyed him. You have to work with the unconscious, and it is a two-way relationship. And one thing I find extraordinary, this is an African story of 17th century. And what does it say that even in the 17th century in Africa, the feminine was so wounded? The old woman, exceedingly ugly, even repulsive, she was covered with open sores. That is what our relationship with the feminine has done. She is so wounded. And I would say from my own experience when I've gone there, I often find her, she is crying so much she cannot even see through her tears. She doesn't even know that you've come to greet her because she is crying so much. But she needs our help. The unconscious needs us. It's not... You see, because in the West we're asphyxiated with the idea of the ego and that we have to do it and we have a goal, we think that's how you work in relationship with the unconscious. You don't. You offer your services to the unconscious. You work with the unconscious. And it is a totally different process. And then, of course, in this story, something very beautiful happens. She is given a necklace more beautiful than the one she had before. And in this particular African tribe, the women's one possession was their necklace. In their necklace was the mark of their individuality. Their own personal identity was their necklace. So what does this say is with working creatively with the unconscious, it gives you back a deeper recognition, a deeper understanding of your own uniqueness than you ever had before. It actually gives you meaning. Because again, just as we've become conned by the fact that happiness comes from outside, we've also become conned by the fact that meaning comes from outside. Meaning to your life depends upon what you do. It does not. It depends on the inner state with which you do it. And you know that perfectly well. If you're happy, you can be happy washing dishes, you can be happy doing anything. It doesn't matter. It's to do with the inner state. And meaning comes from the archetypal inner world. It comes from the dimension of Mushkil Gusha. The archetypes are in fact impacted with meaning. They make your life meaningful. And we have to learn to make a relationship with them and to work with them and to listen to them. That's why we listen to our dreams. We listen to the inner world speaking to us. We make this two-way relationship. As I mentioned yesterday, it is from that two-way relationship that the self is born. The self is the child of this interrelationship. And there is an enormous amount of work, an enormous amount of healing that needs to be done within. The inner psyche is so wounded, it's been so mistreated. I mean, most of you here are women. I'm sure you are conscious of how the outer feminine has been mistreated. But the inner feminine is howling too. And the inner feminine exists within man and within woman. The feminine is the inner world itself, is the world of the soul. If it was wounded 200 years ago in Africa and needed to be licked, how much it is wounded now. So what this stresses is one must have the right attitude towards the unconscious. And whatever happens, avoid the danger of inflation. This is when you identify your ego with the inner processes and the ego goes when you think you're a god, when you think you're a king. If you're not careful, you can end up in a mental asylum thinking you're Napoleon, you're an emperor. And you must always have what, again, T.S. Eliot put it very beautifully, talked of the wisdom of humility. And if you go on the spiritual path, you also get confronted by the danger of inflation. Because there comes a point when you realize that you are God. And that is a very dangerous moment. Because we are God, but it's not the ego that's God. And there is this confusion. In our particular tradition, we usually get hit very hard by the teacher at that point. You can get thrown out of the group or something very... to break it, to stop the inflation. I don't know how it's dealt with in analysis.
Blasphemous is a word in the Catholic Church.
Blasphemous. Yeah, blasphemy is that, yeah. There is always a danger of inflation for anyone exploring their inner depths and the transpersonal forces encountered there. Jung was very aware of this and confronted it himself in the Siegfried dream recorded in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. In this dream, Jung killed Siegfried, who embodied the heroic ideal which imposes itself by force of will. You have to give up doing what you want, because that's the ego. You have to give up thinking you know what to do, because that's the ego. It was Jung's humility that saved him from the danger of so inflated an ego, and he was very aware of the danger of this. He actually had a loaded revolver which he kept at his bedside, and he said if he didn't deal with this crisis now, he would have blown his brains out, because he was aware that it was such a difficult moment for him. He said, he wrote, this identity with Siegfried, the hero, the person who can go off and do it, and my heroic idealism had to be abandoned, for there are higher things than the ego's will, and to these one must bow. Mrs. Tweedy had a similar experience when she was with her teacher. I just quote you this bit. His face was severe. He was half listening, half in samadhi. Samadhi is a superconscious state. I had the feeling I was boring him. He lifted his head and looked me straight in the eyes. Why don't you become a human being? Why don't you try to become less than the dust at my feet? I stared at him. It seemed like an unexpected attack. Am I not a human being? I was amazed and felt forlorn. What you are, I don't know, but a human being you are not, he drawled, and it sounded like a growl. Only when you become less than the dust at my feet will you be balanced. Only then can you be called a human being. C.G. Jung flashed like lightning through my mind. And Mrs. Tweedy continues, I was always convinced the process of individuation is a preliminary step, a springboard, so to say, a starting point to something more, which I think would be yoga or self-realization. The individuation process makes the human being whole, complete, to be able to take his rightful place as a balanced, perfectly normal member of the human family. But yoga is much more than that, and in yoga there must be much more danger, consequently the so-called inflation. At one time during the training, the disciple is bound to begin to realize his divine origin, and then to say and to believe, I am God. It is then one needs a teacher. And the teacher will say, no, be careful. With those lips not yet pure, with the heart not yet as limpid as the waters of life, it is a blasphemy to say you are God. But a great teacher does not say it so directly. He simply teaches humility. Become less than the dust at my feet. How can inflation arise if one is made to be so humble? In my experience, the greatest teacher of humility is one's own shadow. Once you become aware of what you really are and the nasty person you have underneath the nice person you present, then you can't be inflated. The shadow, all the parts of yourself you don't like, they humiliate you more than anything else. And to me this is one of the great benefits of working with the shadow. It is totally humiliating. And this happened to the bush digger. I won't go into the whole ramifications of why it happened and what happened, but he built this wonderful palace. The king came along and saw, gosh, what a wonderful palace he has. The bush digger now became the gem trader, Lali Saudagar, and he wanted to be the equal of the king, and his daughter played with the king's daughter, and then this strange thing happened with the necklace, and the king's daughter accused the bush digger's daughter of stealing her necklace. Basically, an imbalance had occurred. And the world represented by the king and his daughter became threatened by the inflation of the bush digger. And her identity, the conscious identity, became lost, which is to do with the king. And her daughter accused the bush digger's daughter of stealing the necklace. And this is the conflict that happens if you get too inflated. This is the danger. Your conscious world cannot cope with your new inflated identity. In the worst cases, you go off and start a new religion or a new cult. And it is very dangerous, that. You have to be very, very careful. But you'll always get warnings, so it doesn't matter. And what usually happens in my experience is you fall flat on your face and realize what a fool you've made of yourself and become terribly ashamed, and particularly if you do it in public. And in the Sufi group anyway, everybody knows what's happening, and that makes it even more humiliating. And if it isn't humiliating enough, the teacher will tell everybody what happened to you to make it even more humiliating. But you're usually led along and allowed to fall flat on your face. Robert Johnson gave a lovely talk about this, and he used the story of King Lear. I don't know if you know the story of King Lear, who was terribly inflated and thought he was a wonderful king, but didn't want to be bothered to rule, so he asked his daughters to rule for him. And eventually he lost everything and went crazy on the heath. And he had to confront his own stupidity, and that's what taught him the lesson of how inflated he had become. So you will end up, unless you get incredibly inflated, being taught the lesson of humility, being taught the wisdom of humility, and you need that wisdom, you need that humility. Otherwise, the ego identifies with what's happening. The ego says, all this is happening to me, and it's not happening to the ego. It's happening within. The ego is like the tiny top of the iceberg compared to the whole of the unconscious. And the transformation happens within the unconscious. And it very often happens so deep you're not even aware of what's going on, which is as it should be. So the bush digger got thrown into a prison cell, no more sherbet for him. He lived off bread and water, sleeping on dirty straw. Until one Wednesday night he had a dream. When we are asleep, we are more open to the influence of the unconscious, and dreams have always been the easiest form of communication between the transpersonal world and the world of consciousness. In the bush digger's dream, he is approached by a luminous holy man. This holy man is in fact Khidra, the green man, who is an important Middle Eastern figure, who is the figure of direct revelation from God. He brings direct revelation. And he tells the bush digger that he has been inwardly blind because he has forgotten about Mushka Gusha. He has forgotten where his experience came from. He said it was all his, and so rather than being creative, it destroyed him. The bush digger looked only towards the outer world and forgot that the source of his riches was within. From a psychological and spiritual perspective, freedom is only to be found within. To forget about the inner world is to throw away the only key that can open the prison door. All the answers are within us. And that's where all the help comes, and that's the only place we can ever turn to. I remember Jung said once that people came to him in therapy and expected him to solve their problems. And he says, I can't do anything. I can only help you to solve your own problems. The moment you begin to think that you can help somebody else, you certainly can't, and you certainly get in the way and usually cause a foul-up. So, however, there is help is on the way, and the bush digger is told there's a penny hidden under the door sill. Just take it, buy some fruit, and fulfill your vow. Just as the lapis, the self, is the commonest thing, it's our own simple self. So the way to freedom lies through just one penny. To recognize the value of the inner world, to listen to the guidance given by dreams, is something that does not require great wealth. We can all do it, we all have it within us. We just have to trust. Just listen within for a moment, when a door can open that will change your whole life. It's so simple, but we all want something else. We all want something magnificent. We don't really want to listen. It's like the Sufi says, if you ever have a question, ask your heart, and your heart will always tell you the truth. But you've got to be prepared for the answer, and you've got to create a space to listen. And again, just as he had to knock three times at the beginning, he has to ask three times at the end before someone buys him the fruit and he acknowledges Mushka Gusha. He goes through this inner ritual of saying, yes, that's where the help comes from within. He acknowledges it. Once he reenacted the ritual of sharing the dried fruit, telling the story of Mushka Gusha, wholeness returns to his life, for he has recognized his reconnected his individual consciousness with the self, the archetype of wholeness. He has again affirmed that connection. If we cut off that connection, we get into a mess. The whole process of working within oneself, the whole process of individuation, is towards making a connection with the self. Mr. Tweedy once said, the goal of every path of yoga is to lead a guided life, guided by that within us which is eternal. And just as the whole process of analysis takes one to the stage where one can work within without the need of another, one can work creatively with one's own unconscious without the need of somebody else. And that's the whole spiritual process, is just learning to make that connection, to forge that connection. Then it doesn't matter where you are. You have that connection with your own higher self, which knows, which just knows, which just is. And then, of course, the situation changes. And you see, life is not as it appears. We think there are conscious laws of cause and effect, but there is a whole different mechanism of life that works from within. But suddenly a situation changes. You find that once you've learned your lesson, you see, from an inner perspective, you come into situations because you have something to learn from them. You don't have something to get, you have something to learn from them. It's a very different approach to life, rather than the sort of cowboy mentality, life's out there to get what I want. And either you're a, I think particularly in the American culture, either you're a winner or a loser. Either you get it or you don't get it. Either you're a success or a failure. And I guess it must be very difficult to live with that, those opposites all the time, either success or failure, either winner or loser. But from the inner point of view, life is not about that at all. There's a lovely poem by Rudyard Kipling called If, when he talks about success and failure and treating those two imposters just the same. Because there is no success, there is no failure, there is just... Have you learned from the experience you've attracted to yourself? Because remember, you attract all your situations to...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.